not impossible. I just thought that the bank was coming to you.
Hi, Krista. Okay. 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 Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so you want me to stay logged on?
No, no, you can, I think you can disappear and then or you can stay as you like. But,
okay. I'll log on in about 15 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll keep the Skype running.
Yeah,
I'll, and I'll just turn off the audio.
Okay, fantastic.
All right. Thank you. See you.
Just maybe it's here. So welcome back to the second session of the annual workshop. We now have Professor Patrizio Campisi speaking on smartphone-based authentication. It's another European Union project that deals with smartphone-based biometrics and smartphone-based authentication. I'm sure we would be, it would be very interesting to hear the other perspective from a different project terms of smartphone biometrics. Welcome to TZU.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. First of all, I would like to thank Kiran and Christoph for inviting me to attend this event. And every time I come back here in this specific room, I always wonder why there is a door here. But maybe we won't have any question. Anyway, so kidding aside, so my name is Patrizio Campisi, as Kiran said. I am with Roma Tre University in Rome, where I head the Biometric Systems and Multimedia Forensics Lab. So a little bit of folklore, being Italian. So Roma Tre University was founded in 1992, and as you can see from the logo is just a sketch of the only pyramid that we have in Italy. This pyramid is called the Piramide Cestia. It was built around the 8th-12th before Christ. And since we are in the area or where the pyramid is, so we just got the chance to get the logo. And this arch is the arch you can see here in the San Paolo area. So this my university was founded some years ago because the main university in Rome was overcrowded with more than 100,000 students. So in order to help a little bit the situation, this university was founded, and since its foundation now we have around 35,000 students. We have all the faculties but medical school. We don't have the medical school. As you can see, we have more or less 900 faculty members, 12 departments, and a good number of PhD students. So just to give you an idea where we are located, as you can see, this is the ring road surrounding Rome. We have three universities, La Sapienza, Tor Vergata, and Roma Tre University, which is located in the southwest area of Rome. The way the university was, since, as we can imagine, Rome is kind of ancient city, old city, it's a little bit difficult to build a new university from scratch in a city like Rome. So we used a different approach. So we renewed the old buildings in what was in the 50s the suburb of the city. Now it's almost a city center. So the different faculties are spread around the city. But nicely enough, they are along the subway stations. So if you get the subway, you can commute from one faculty to another. And we are located around this area. And that's a picture of our engineering campus taken a couple of days ago. So what we do in the lab, we have kind of widespread range of activities. So we work on multimedia forensics as well as biometrics, and within biometrics we focus on many different aspects like privacy enhancing technologies. We work on behavioral biometrics like keystroke and signature, naive biometrics like electroencephalography, and many other things. So I'm here today not to give answers but to have answers from you. So we recently got financed a project from the European Commission. The name of the project is AMBER, which stands for Enhanced Mobile Biometrics. And this project is within one of the three pillars within the H2020 framework, which is the Excellent Science pillar. Within this pillar, you have one specific kind of project, which are called Marie Slovotska Curie actions, and these actions are essentially within these actions, actually, you have different kind of possibility, and one is the so-called innovative training network. The general scope of this initiative is to train early stage researchers, and to do so you have different kind of approaches. One is, for example, the European training networks. In this case, you have to join at least three partners from three academic partners from different countries in Europe, or the European industrial doctorate. In this case, you need one academic partner able to give out to award, I mean, a PhD, and at least one industrial partner. And then you have the European joint doctorates. In this case, you can have at least, you must have at least three organizations so that you can award a double or multiple PhD degree. Well, the project we are involved in is an innovative training network, and specifically European training network. So this project has a duration of 48 months, starting January 1st of this year, and the budget is around 2.5 million euros. So, who are the beneficiaries? So, essentially, we have five universities involved. One is the University of Kent, which is actually the coordinator, Universidad Carlos III in Madrid, the Magdeburg University in Germany, the Warsaw Technical University in Poland, Warsaw, and the Roma Tre University. Along with these academic partners, we also have actually using the H2020 wording, we are beneficiaries because we get the funding. And together with the beneficiaries, we also have the partners, which are industrial partners, that actually don't get any money, but they host our researchers for a certain period of time to make them improve their skills. And we have a fair good number of industrial partners. So we have IBM, Nubo Solution, 11 Path, both based in Spain. Then we have Genki based in the Netherlands, Scali in Germany, NASC in Poland, and Namirial in Austria. So it is really out of question that mobile platforms are becoming wider and wider, more and more spread among users. So let's say that if you get into the subway from a situation like this in the old times, you get to a situation like this one, where everybody is surfing tablets, smartphones, and so it is really there is a real need from the end users to use mobile devices to do many things, like also online banking, mobile payment, and this need is taken in serious account by vendors that on the other side tend to embed biometric sensors into mobile devices. For example, I'm thinking about fingerprint sensors, which are specifically designed for mobile applications, but also to adapt the sensors which come by default in the devices, like, for example, a camera. So, we are at a point where we cannot proceed further without addressing some serious concerns that can come from the end users, because the end users, of course, need to be confident in terms of privacy, security, performance they can get from their devices, and also in terms of usability and reliability. Of course, if we compromise between all these different aspects, this might bring to mistrust, and so the users could not be willing anymore to use mobile applications for serious stuff like payment or online banking. So within this kind of framework, here is our focus. So essentially, our line of research will be on privacy and security, and also to enhance the confidence that the users have in mobile applications. Also, we will try to pay a lot of attention, significant attention, to put the user to implement a user-centric approach, so that the user can be the real master of his own data. Another line of research we will follow regards is related to usability and reliability. We will try to answer questions like how to design usable and reliable biometric systems on mobile platforms. And also we will also try to explore different kind of novel, I would say, biometrics on mobile devices. Mobile devices can allow you to use a different kind of biometrics rather than the usual ones like face, fingerprint, or iris. So, as we have learned very well this morning in the first talk, mobility introduces a lot of threats which are not really characteristic when we have to deal with tethered networks. For example, we can lose the device or the device can be robbed, and this is of course a problem. On top of it, we cannot forget that the device we are handling has limited power, computational power, but also energy-wise. And so we need to deal with that, because of course we cannot really implement on the device very demanding algorithms or processing strategies. And of course this may bring, but should not, this may bring to a situation where we can lack appropriate countermeasures to some threats that can arise when dealing with mobile applications. On top of that, now each mobile device is equipped with sensors, inertial sensors, or for example GPS locators. So this together with the internet can provide some information regarding what's going on, how the device is being used, if the device is being used indoor, outdoor, where the device, where you and therefore also the device are, how you are holding the device, if you are standing or if you are moving. And of course this kind of information can be very useful, because can help in designing in a proper way user interfaces, or they can be used to implement adaptive algorithms, also to put in place some security countermeasures, which is something that of course we like. But at the same time, if we dig into this kind of information, some privacy risk can arise. Of course, taking decision on the base where you are, what you are doing, where you are going, can somehow help in some sense, but also can provide, can get you some privacy troubles. And that's something that we don't like. So, within this kind of framework, we will try to design some tools to protect data, specifically for the mobile environment, to protect the system from fraudulent use, and also, as I already said, to put the user at the center of the data management. And this will be implemented through a kind of sub-projects. And so specifically we will focus on some privacy enhancing technologies to be adapted somehow or to be designed from scratch for the mobile scenario, taking into account that, for example, the intra-class variability when you are dealing with mobile devices is much higher because of course of the operational environment you are moving, or the environmental conditions are not optimal, illumination problems, and all this kind of stuff. Also, we need to take into account that privacy-enhancing technologies often requires cryptographic primitives, and we need to deal also with the limited computational capacity of the mobile devices we are holding. Also, as was very well outlined this morning, we have the presentation attack, which is a real problem, and it's something that has to be dealt with if we don't want the user to lose confidence when dealing with mobile devices. Together with privacy-enhancing technologies, we also would like to design some transparency-enhancing tools which could allow to achieve transparency, visibility, and user centricity when dealing with the data management problem. This means that this can be implemented using, for example, trying to transpose the fair information principles into the mobile scenario, implementing anonymization forms. But we will see during the project. Another issue, another line of research we'll be following is related to usability and reliability. Of course, we don't have to forget that the digital divide is something we need to face. Using these kind of devices could not be easy for aged people. It depends if you are familiar with the technology, if you are reluctant to accept the technology. So the point is that we would like to provide solutions which are adaptable to the needs of the citizens according to their age, their education, their capabilities. And also we will pay attention to the design of optimal interaction approaches with mobile devices. Like, for example, sensor positioning. So if I remember well, I'm not an iPhone user, but if I remember well, the iPhone has a fingerprint sensor in the front. Other phones, like the one I have in the back. So I just hold the phone, I put my finger on the back, and I get authenticated. So this kind of issues. And also, we have to deal. Okay, this is with specifically designed sensors for this kind of application. But also, we can take advantage of the sensors which are already embedded in the device. Like, for example, the camera. And we have to deal with the fact that very often these sensors are not specifically designed to be used for that specific purpose. As a matter of fact, now vendors are also trying to embed infrared cameras with infrared sensitivity, for example, in laptops, and this shows an interesting trend. So essentially, given that these mobile devices are touch-based devices, we also need to understand, in order to empower usability of the system, how and where to place the sensors, how to interact with the user, and how to get a feedback from the user in order to be able to be adaptive to the user's need. And as it was mentioned before, this aging problem is very important. I think, in my opinion, nowadays we cannot really work on biometrics if we don't really take into account a longitudinal data set, which means a data set collected from the same users at different time of different times, so with a time span as long as possible. I understand that this is very difficult because you need to have the users back in the lab for data acquisition several times across 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. But I think that's a very crucial point to understand how the system is robust, if the system is robust against this kind of problem. And also, once we understand which are the problems related to aging, we need also to understand how to compensate the problems that come with aging. Oops. Again, mobile devices can be used, are used usually in an unsupervised environment, which makes these devices very vulnerable. And the whole procedure, I would say, the whole authentication recognition procedure, very vulnerable. So we need to produce to an assessment and also a mitigation framework for this. The third line of research we will be following within the project is related to the exploitation of the new modalities that you can have dealing with touch mobile devices, like, for example, drawing or swipe. Modalities can be used independently, or they can be used in conjunction with what we call traditional biometrics, like, for example, voice, face, and the fingerprint. So the point is how to understand to combine to design a multi-biometric system working with this new modalities. I'm running short of time, so I will be quick. So essentially, we will try to deal with continuous and instantaneous authentication using swipe interactions. So we will try to collect a longitudinal data set, and we will try to implement recognition in both continuous way and also one-time based, so a ceremony-based recognition approach, and then we will try, as I already said, to design multi-biometric systems using both new modalities and also the data that you can get from the mobile device. Of course, all these projects I've talked about are not really independent of each other, but they are interconnected, and that's more or less the way they interconnect. In Roma 3, we will work essentially on template protection and privacy management, and the multi-biometrics privacy and countermeasure. And of course, we plan to exchange stuff and information with the other partner. So the way the project is implemented is through the opening of 10 positions for early stage researchers, which means two per partner. Each position will last 36 months with a quite competitive but standard salary. During these 36 months, 10 months will be spent abroad on secondment, both at the academic partners and at the industrial partners. So if you want some more details about the project itself, you can approach me with no problem, or you can go and visit the amber-biometrics.eu, where you can find all the possible information. And now, as I said, it's time for answers, not really for questions. Thank you for your attention and patience.
Thank you, Patrizio. I think it is a very interesting project that you have, where you try to profile also the biometrics in terms of continuous authentication mode, combining with the physical biometrics. We have time for one or two questions, so I will set up the next speaker up. Are there any questions?
I don't want questions, I want answers.
Any answers?
No, but I, from the previous talks, you know, there are some interesting points.
Now we have the next speaker of our workshop, Professor Arun Ross. Unfortunately, due to recent governmental changes in the US travel policies, he could not travel to Norway. Despite the fact that he could not travel, he has put his efforts to wake up very early in the morning. I think it's 5 o'clock in the morning there, Arun. So it's up early.
Yeah,
I think so I think this is a perfect example of Science Without Borders. with that, I would like to hand over the stage to Arun.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Once again, I regret that I'm not there in person. I hope you can hear me clearly. If not, please please let me know. I'd like to thank Kiran, Christoph, and Martha for inviting me to this program. And again, although I'm not there in person, I'm sure all of you are having a lot of fun. I enjoyed Patrizio's presentation just before this. And what I'm going to talk about today is on the topic of ocular biometrics, again, in the context of smartphones, but now focusing on the ocular region of the eye. So if you see the next slide here, we begin to see that the mobile phone market is expanding very quickly, and also the coverage is increasing very rapidly. So for example, the ITU statistics from 2014, which is now already 2 years outdated, said that there were about 7 billion mobile subscriptions, not subscribers, of course, subscriptions worldwide. And if you think about programs like M-Pesa, which was launched in Kenya and Tanzania, which is used for undertaking financial services using the smartphone, one begins to see and observe that it's quite evident that the mobile phone market is going to play a critical role, not just for other technologies, but also for biometrics. So if we go to slide number three, the next one, you will see that incorporation of biometric solutions in smartphones is fairly recent in terms of its large-scale adoption, with examples like Face Unlock, and then, of course, the Android fingerprint in 2011, and then the iOS Touch ID 2013, and then the Iris Passport 2015. So we are now beginning to see that biometrics is being used for authentication in these devices. In the next slide, you'll see that smartphone payment systems are also becoming very popular. So if you think of Android Pay, which was initiated only in September 2015, is already accepted at over 1 million stores. And if you think of Apple Pay, which was again initiated only in October 2014, it is being supported by a large number of banks. You have millions of capable devices. And so it's quite evident that the smartphone is playing a critical role in our contemporary society. And what is intriguing is the amount of information that is resident in the smartphone, what we would call as personal information. But besides the personal information, the smartphone itself is becoming very powerful in terms of computation. And so it is being used as a conduit, if you will, in order to undertake many other operations, because even simple things like accessing websites, performing banking transactions, things like that are now being conducted through the smartphones. So one way of looking at this is the smartphone has not only become an integral part of one's life, but it's almost now associated with an individual. So very often, if you were to identify the smartphone, then you, in some sense, you have identified the user or the owner, or at least a subset of users who are associated with the smartphone. So that's how prevalent smartphones are. And as we saw in an earlier slide, its adoption in the worldwide market, including markets in which traditionally technology has taken a longer time to be embraced, even in those types of markets, we're beginning to see that the smartphone is playing a critical role. If you look at slide number 5, and I'm sure the other speakers have also pointed this out, is the number of sensors within the confines of a smartphone is also increasing. And so, of course, we are all familiar with the camera, but then you have sensors such as the ambient light proximity detector. Some of them have fingerprint sensors. And then you have NFC, Bluetooth, GPS, barometer, accelerometer, gyroscope, magnetometer, microphone, touchscreens, 3D touchscreens, etc. In other words, it's an environment that is replete with a large number of sensors. So these sensors are capturing information about the user. They're also capturing information about the environment. And they're also capturing information about the state of the phone. So in other words, just by looking at this raw data and processing it, one can glean so much information, not just about the phone, but also about the user and the environment in which the user is immersed. So clearly, it is required to exploit this large amount of data that is resident in the smartphone, but it also raises issues of privacy and security. And one of the things that we have been investigating is the notion of privacy leakage, which I think even Patrizio had alluded to, which is the amount of personal information that can be inadvertently leaked when one uses a smartphone. If one were to do a forensic analysis of the smartphone memory, that would also divulge more information than what we would normally assume. And so it is quite evident that privacy and security of these devices is paramount, especially in the light of what was just stated, the multiplicity of sensors, the sensitivity of data, and the personal connection one has with the smartphone. So in slide number 6, the opportunity for biometrics in the context of smartphone is unprecedented. Now, if you were to look at this purely from a user authentication standpoint, in other words, the arena where biometrics meets with smartphone is in the authentication framework. And of course, there is only one aspect in which biometrics meets with smartphones. There are several other types of arenas in which the two technologies can come together. But if you look at the authentication arena, there are two types of biometric traits as it pertains to the smartphone: obtrusive and unobtrusive or non-obtrusive. And maybe this is not the best choice of terminology, but the point here is to convey that some biometric traits are explicitly acquired from the user, whereas other biometric traits are implicitly acquired without the user's knowledge, or from another perspective, the user does not have to explicitly interact with the sensors in order to authenticate herself or himself. So on the left, you see some examples of obtrusive ways of authenticating an individual. combination of biometrics and non-biometrics, for example, PIN. The user is explicitly typing in some values. Or if you look at fingerprint sensors where the user is explicitly placing his or her finger on the sensor. On the other hand, on the right-hand side of this view graph, you see unobtrusive examples where the sensor can measure gait patterns or utilize touch dynamics or even the location of the user in order to determine who the user is and also to authenticate the user, what we would call as covertly or silently. And so you have a very rich arena where biometrics and the smartphone can meet and where the opportunities are paramount, as was also pointed out by the previous speaker. So in slide number 7, when we start talking about ocular biometrics, it is quite clear from the foregoing discussion that it's only a slice of the larger opportunities that we see. Now, I've been talking about opportunities from a technological standpoint and also from a business or financial standpoint, but it's quite evident that the opportunities are paramount even for researchers who are developing this technology, who are conducting empirical analysis, who are developing novel algorithms. It is quite evident that some of the algorithms and privacy constructs that were created for classical biometric system have to be substantially altered in order to ensure that they're working in this arena. So we are, in fact, talk about mobile devices or mobile devices, where the term mobile is referred to modern phones, tablets, and similar smart devices. And this is especially important with the advent of the Internet of Things, IoT, where it's not just a single smartphone with which the user is interacting, but because there is a connection to such devices, one has to take into account the dynamics of IoT in order to understand in order to holistically understand the impact of biometrics on this technology. And slide number 8, you see efforts toward incorporating mobile iris recognition and mobile biometrics started very early, relatively speaking. For example, most of you know Smart Sensors Limited, which a number of years ago had ported their Iris SDK onto the Android operating system, so suggesting that Iris will have a critical role to play in the smartphone ecosystem. And then Delta ID, which will soon be merging with fingerprint cards, uses near-infrared access trees to perform iris recognition, because one of the constraints previously for the use of iris recognition in smartphones was the lack of NIR detector, which is essential for performing iris recognition, at least for traditional iris recognition. And now when OEMs begin to manufacture cameras which have the ability to incorporate NIR accessories, near-infrared accessories, then iris recognition could become a natural byproduct. Now, even several years ago, the company A-Optics, they developed a hardware peripheral which was equipped with an iris sensor. So it was a regular smartphone, but they had a sleeve, and when that sleeve was placed over the smartphone, it converted the smartphone into an iris sensor and could be used for iris processing. So people have thought of many different ways in which the ocular biometrics, and specifically iris biometrics, could be incorporated into the smartphone systems. And the company iVerify, which was recently bought out by Ant Financial, the Alibaba Group, uses ocular patents to authenticate a mobile phone user. So you have a lot of examples like this in which biometrics playing, or rather iris recognition and ocular biometrics, is beginning to play an important role. In slide number 9, I'm not sure if the video works. If not, it's okay. But if you're able to run that video, it's only a few seconds worth a clip, so I'm not sure if it... and you will see the user just glancing at the smartphone, and the smartphone authenticates the user and then grants her access to its resources. So there are benefits when ocular biometrics is used, where a user is just expected to glance, and therefore one could imagine a situation in which this can be used for continuous authentication, in some cases without the user's knowledge, very covertly as the user interacts with the smartphone in order to verify the user's identity, but in a continuous authentication framework. So in the next slide, when we talk about ocular biometrics in a smartphone, we have at least many different ways of going about this taxonomy. But in the remaining few minutes, I'd like to have present this from two different perspectives. On one hand, you have in-device processing, where a user is authenticated prior to accessing resources on the phone. Or you do outsourced processing, where you utilize the smartphone sensor to acquire ocular and other attendant data, but processing is done remotely. Now, for a moment, I want to reflect on these two paradigms, because in paradigm one, which is the in-device processing, biometrics is being used prior to accessing resources on the phone. So it authenticates the user. It ensures that the right user is accessing the phone. That's one paradigm. The other paradigm, the iris could just be viewed as a regular device, which has the ability to capture information on the move because of its ergonomic design. People can carry it to multiple places. And so now you use the device only as a conduit to acquire ocular data, but processing could be done remotely. Now, this second paradigm is something that we've been investigating, where the smartphone is merely used as a medium in order to do something that is beyond authentication. So if you go to slide number 11, this is something where we've been building a system which is involves the cloud and the smartphone. So ocular images are acquired using a smartphone camera. You can imagine a law enforcement officer or a border control agent who's able to take the picture of a person's eye. And then the computationally intensive portions are outsourced to the cloud. Now, what we're trying to build here is what we call as an ecosystem where smartphones and algorithm developers interact. So there are multiple processing algorithms that are available in the cloud. Why is that important? Because the technology for processing ocular images is rapidly increasing. And if a smartphone were to make a commitment to one or two algorithms, then it's missing out on the rich set of algorithms that are developed almost every day, if you will. So here the goal is to have an ecosystem where developers upload algorithms into the cloud. And the smartphone, upon acquiring ocular data, dynamically selects an algorithm on a case-by-case basis. And if your algorithm is selected, then a micropayment is issued to developer whose algorithm is selected. So what we're really talking about here is harnessing the cloud to perform iris ocular recognition in a smartphone environment. So the ecosystem itself can be seen in the next slide. And if you see, there are three orange boxes. These are the three players: the user, the developer, and the cloud environment. And the user has the ability to upload images via an interface onto the cloud. The cloud does the processing and provides the result. And if you look at the second orange bar right at the bottom, you will see the consortium of developers who upload algorithms using a common interface, and their algorithm, after some automatic review, is embedded in the cloud. And anytime a specific algorithm is chosen, here we have iris algorithm 1, iris algorithm 2, ocular algorithm 1. Anytime any algorithm is chosen, then the particular vendor or developer is rendered a micropayment. So if there are 1,000 calls to this cloud environment, and if your algorithm is chosen 200 times, then a certain payment is rendered, a micropayment. It could be 10 cents, 10 US cents, or 50 US cents every time an operation is undertaken. So this gives the opportunity for the cloud to ingest multiple algorithms. So no vendor is dismissed right away. Unless, of course, if your algorithm is never selected, then perhaps the environment will not require that particular algorithm. But this kind of an ecosystem gives the user the opportunity to access the latest algorithms. It gives developers the opportunity to keep improving their algorithm while also understanding that they are in the fray. They are always under consideration by these algorithms. It's beneficial for the cloud because the cloud now has a choice of algorithms which it can dispense to the user. So we've done a prototype of this along with researchers at my former institute, West Virginia University. We have a system that is running in-house, and we plan to expand that in order to see if this kind of a business model will be beneficial for small players in the iris recognition community and perhaps even in the biometrics community. So if you go to slide number 13, there are several challenges if one were to perform ocular biometrics in a smartphone by using the classical camera. So I'm not talking about the infrared camera, I'm just talking about color camera. What are the challenges? These challenges are easily resolved. That's bullet point 3. And images can be acquired in various type of lighting conditions. The resolution and viewpoint of images can change. Images can be blurred or occluded with glasses. And so if you were to see in the next slide, data provided by Professor Maria DiMarchico and the MISH data set, as it were, some of these challenges can be seen where we may not have to perform iris recognition, but can perform ocular recognition, where the periocular region is also used in conjunction with the ocular region that includes the iris in order to improve the performance. Now, again, this comment has to be balanced out with my earlier comment that some devices, like the one produced by Delta ID, already have NIR-based cameras embedded in them, which means iris recognition, perhaps without the ocular region, can be done in a reliable way. But if you go to the ecosystem that I was talking about, these modalities can be used. And so some of the challenges in slide number 15, if you go to slide number 16, one challenge would be the next slide. Thank you, Kiran. In the next slide, you see, here you see sensor positioning, where the diversity of images that can be obtained if one were to do monocular recognition, just one side of the face. And then in the next slide, you can see illumination problems because different people hold the smartphone differently with respect to the camera that can cause some challenges. And you also see some challenges associated with blurred image and with the presence of glasses. And if you go to the next slide, you could also have some other inadvertent challenges where there can be two people inadvertently imaged in the system. So clearly, there are lots of fundamental challenges that has to be dealt with in the context of this modality. Go to slide number 19. Often, we have to justify as to why can't we just use the face? Why do we have to use the ocular when you potentially can utilize the entire face? And there are pros and cons to this. Really, there is a natural flow or increase of information, one would think, as you move from iris to face in this example. Iris beginning at the upper left and the face at the lower right. But as you move closer to the iris, you obviously get a lot of stochastic information associated with the iris, making it unique. But then as you get to the face, you get a much more holistic information. And that can also be detrimental in some cases because of the deformation of the object and because of lighting changes can cause more intra-class variations because the face in some sense is a self-occluding object. So this is always an important question to answer as we move from iris to periocular to biocular to face. what are the computational and performance advantages? And this has been studied, if you look at slide number 20, in the context of periocular biometrics in general, where it has been demonstrated that under some conditions, in this view graph, that periocular can actually perform better than face. But now with the advent of deep learning methods and super resolution methods, it is quite clear that face also can be very competitive in such unconstrained environment or in such occluded environment. I'm not going to spend much time on it, but I just want to briefly mention one of the things that we've been examining is how do you combine the matching algorithm with what we call as the presentation attack algorithms. What happens if someone is trying to spoof someone else's biometric modality, or if someone is trying to obfuscate their own identity? So how can the matching algorithms that are developed be appropriated for the purpose of presentation attack detection? This is an important question, and I think Patrizio also alluded to it, primarily because, as I said earlier on, the sensitivity of information present in the smartphone, but also if smartphone is used as the gateway for accessing many other types of information, then it is very essential that at that gateway, an appropriate authentication is conducted. Secondly, there can be a lot of change in the types of images that are being extracted by these systems. I gave you some examples of intra-class variations, but there can be lots of challenges. And so one thing that we're doing, and again, this is the last thing that I'm going to talk about, we're out of time. And one of the things here is to avoid using algorithms that depend a lot on training data. And especially in this day and age where deep learning is extensively used, it is always tempting to expose the system to a wide variety of training images in order to develop a robust neural network-based solution. But that may not always be feasible because of the challenges involved. So one of the things that that we've been looking at is, if you go to slide number 22 and 23 and so on and so forth, is to see how, slide number 25, how can we use very simple operators which require minimal training in order to do both matching and presentation attack detection. The goal here is to avoid exposing the system to large amounts of training data, because then the system can overfit itself to that particular data. So that is something that we have been investigating. And I won't go into detail, but slide number 26, 27, 28 talk about some of the algorithms that we are developing, very simple algorithms, deliberately, not to necessarily simplify the problem as much as understanding that extremely learning-based schemes or extreme learning-based schemes can be detrimental in some cases. So here's my final slide. I really want to focus on bullet point number 3 and bullet point 5. Bullet point number 3 is cross-camera evaluation. And this goes into my earlier comment about being prudent in the training process, not to overfit the classifier, especially if you're doing subspace analysis or a deep learning-based scheme that can potentially depend on a lot of training data, which can either result in overfitting or which demands large amounts of data. And then finally, bullet point number 5, providing biometric algorithms as a service is an emerging business model. And this can open streams of revenue for developers while allowing users and clients to access the latest algorithms. So there's plenty of opportunity, as I stated in my earlier slide, but there's also the need for developing smart algorithms that are able to operate in these types of environment. And finally, viewing the smartphone merely as a gateway, not as the end of the authentication process, but as the beginning of the access process, in which the smartphone is merely a conduit to access greater resources. I've run out of time, so I'll stop there. Appreciate your patience, and I thank you for accommodating this talk in this remote fashion. If you have any questions and time permits, I'll be glad to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Arif. I think we can accommodate one or two questions if there are any. I have a question, Arun. Where you talk about
Kiran, I had the opportunity to ask questions during your defense, so now you have the opportunity to ask me some questions.
Yeah. Time for revenge. Yeah, well, the paradigm of creating a new ecosystem. I don't remember this slide number. Yeah, slide number here. So think this is rather a different paradigm than the ones that the standards have been pushing for, where they say that, okay, the biometric data is not supposed to leave the device, and everything has to happen within the device. And I assume most of the experts from Europe, they would support this. And what you are taking is a completely different paradigm to create the ecosystem where
Correct.
You send the data.
Right.
How would you think the acceptance for such kind of new disrupting thinking would be received?
Yeah, so that's a good question. That's a good question, Kiran. So here the paradigm views the smartphone as a gateway, not as the resource itself. So clearly, if one is offering private data to the smartphone, then one expects some degree of privacy, which is, as you rightly point out, a lot of standard bodies are gravitating toward that. At the same time, there is this tremendous opportunity to use the smartphone only as the gateway which images are ingested into the smartphone and then uploaded onto the cloud in a secure way in order to gain much more computational prowess, but also to do things beyond what can be done within the smartphone environment in a common ecosystem. So this is where the opportunity is. And then this coupled with the business model, where developers are always in the fray, it's not like a bidding competition where one or two vendors win the competition and the others are sent home. Here, there's an opportunity for multiple players to be embedded in this ecosystem and contribute their expertise and resources into the system. So the paradigm itself is fundamentally different from the classical authentication-based paradigm that is very popular. And like you rightly point out, there is more thought has to be given to this. The business model itself has to be evaluated, which is what we're doing now with the business school at Michigan State University, to understand the economic viability and feasibility, but at the same time ensuring that security and privacy are maintained.
Thank you, Arun. That is a very interesting thought. We have one more question from the audience.
Thank you. Thank you for a very nice and pedagogic presentation. First, just to go on this subject, are you mentioning this new paradigm because eye biometrics like iris, retina, ocular require more calculation, more computational power than a traditional smartphone can deliver or will deliver in the near future? Is it really related to this eye biometric issue?
Yeah, so there was a little bit of static on the line, but I think the question was, appreciate the question, thank you. I think the question was, is this paradigm primarily for computational benefits? And the answer is, it goes, yes, there is a computational advantage in getting some computational power beyond what the smartphone can potentially offer. But this paradigm also allows to do much more larger number of operations. For example, video analytics or ocular analytics, which go beyond what is commonly done for authentication. Or multiple images can be uploaded using this gateway, the gateway being the smartphone, while at the same time encouraging developers to come up with novel algorithms. So it's a service-based model where multiple biometric vendors offer different types of services which are availed through a combination of the smartphone and the cloud environment. I hope my answer was clear. I apologize, I did not catch your full question, but I hope that at least answers a part of your question.
Yeah, I think more or less satisfied. maybe because of connectivity issues, we'll have to deal with them. I would like to thank you so much for the time you have put and the effort you have put in waking up early to present the interesting topic. Thank you once again, Arun.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Kiran, and thanks for the
I would now like to introduce next speaker, Martin Stokinas. He has been working with our group on, especially on protection of templates, biometric templates. And he would be talking on how they can be done on smartphones and what advantages they bring to the smartphone. So I would hand over the stage to Martin.
Thank you, Kira. Can you hear me in the speakers? Okay. Yeah. So my name is Martin Stokinas, and I am a PhD candidate here at NTNU Gjøvik, and I work in the biometrics lab on a project which is called SWAN, which is sponsored by the Norwegian Research Council. And the project is about mobile biometrics and all the different aspects that it entails. Yeah, so this is the basic outline. I will talk a little bit about biometric template protection, and then I will show a system that we developed on the smartphones which has template protection included, and then some of the experiments and results that we have done. So as we have seen already today, biometrics has become more and more popular in smartphones, and this of course brings all the security and privacy aspects that we have described. Your biometrics are permanent, which means that you cannot change it like you can your password or your PIN code. And we have also seen cases where biometric data have been exposed or people have stolen the biometric data. So we need some method to protect the data while it's stored. And for that we have biometric template protection, and it has two main properties which have been defined by in ISO standards. And the first one is irreversibility. It means that it should be infeasible to reconstruct the original biometric data from the stored template. And it should also be unlinkable, which means that you should not be able to link, if you have two samples, it should not be possible to link it to a specific subject. So there have already been developed many different methods for biometric template protection. You have biometric crypto systems where you try to bind some key to the biometric data, or try to generate some key from the biometric data that you can use. Then you have feature transformation, so you, similar to hash functions, you try to find a way to transform it from the biometric data to a new format where you cannot go back to the original data. And then recently we also have homomorphic encryptions, which basically you can encrypt the data and then you can perform operations on the in the encrypted domain. So what we have been used in our system is feature transformation. So this is basic components. We capture images using the smartphone camera, and then we segment the face and the eye regions, and then we extract features based on binarized statistical image features, and then we use a template protection method based on Bloom filters, and then we obtain the comparison scores, and we do score level fusions. Yeah, so this is a basic diagram of the system. We have the pre-processing, feature extraction, do you have a pointer? Okay. Yeah, so we basically have all the normal components that you find in a biometric system. So we first take a picture of the face, and then we detect all the different regions, the face and the two eye regions. And then we do feature extraction from those three images. So we use we divide first into 32 blocks, and then we use this binary statistical image features, which are a set of filters which are learned from natural images. And we use 8 different patch sizes. And in each patch size, there are 8 filters. And the response from the filtering results in a 256-bit encoded values. So we get, as a result, from each block, we get 8 encoded images. And then we take the histogram of all these encoded images, so we get 8 histograms from each block. So that means that we end up with 32 times 8 histograms. And in total, that means 256 histograms with values from 0 to 256. And then, because of how the template protection method works, we need binary data. So we have to binarize the feature vector. And we basically just take all the values above 0 and set it to 1 and keep all the zeros as 0. And the way the template protection works is that we pick out a small block of 4 times 16 values. And then we take each column, encode it as an index in this 16-bit array, and set the element in the encoded index to 1. And then we do this 16 times for each of the arrays. And that means that if you have this array, it becomes very difficult to identify what was the original block that created it, because you have no information about how these numbers were input, like the sequence. And you also don't know how many, and also if a column maps to an index which already has a 1, it is still kept as 1. So you don't know how many of the elements are encoded in each one. So that makes it very difficult to reverse the template. And in total, we end up with 1024 of these for the face, eye, and pericular. So the final template will be 2 kilobytes for each of the modalities. And then this is how we compare the templates. And we fuse the scores from the three different, so we fuse face, the left eye, and the right eye. And we end up with one score that we use in the final decision. So we did some experiments. First, we did the security evaluation of the system, and then we did one experiment on an offline database where images were already collected from the smartphone. And then we also did evaluation in real time. So people were using the application on the device and trying to authenticate themselves. So we had, in total, we used one dataset with 21 subjects for developing the methods, and then we had an evaluation database which contained 73 subjects. And for the real-time experiment, we had 22 subjects, where they had first enrolled 5 images, and then they were trying to authenticate themselves over a set of days. So to evaluate the security, we used a framework which was recently developed by a colleague from Darmstadt. And the point is here, to assess the irreversibility, we want to somehow analyze what is the difficulty of going from the protected template and back to the original. So these are all steps in a way to finding it, but the success probability here is the value we can use to somehow assess how difficult it would be to go from the protected template back to the original. And then the last one is showing the level of unlinkability. So a lower number is better. And unlinkability we can also see in these graphs where we have simulated the distribution of scores from two different applications. So if it was perfectly unlinkable, the two distributions would be perfectly overlapping. So this is the graph showing for phase. So we can see it's not perfectly overlapping. And the same for the left periocular and the right periocular. And then we did, as I said, evaluation on the database. So here we can see the recognition performance for the individual modalities. So just for phase, and then the left periocular and right, and then fused together. And this is before we apply the protection method. And on the right side, we have the same experiment, but with the protect templates. So we can see that there is a degradation in the performance. Here, 100% would be mean that there were no false rejects. But we see it drops by around 8% after we apply the template protection. But when we take all the three elements together, all the face, and both eyes, we can see that we achieve much higher performance, and also the difference before and after protection becomes less. Yeah, so this is basically graphs showing the same result, where higher up in the left corner is better. So the blue one is for the face, and the red and yellow is for the left and right eye. So this is before protection, this is after protection. And this is showing the same for the fused modalities. This is the result from the real-time evaluation. We have also here, these two are showing before we apply a protection method. On the left side, we have the genuine attempts. That means that they were trying to log in as themselves. And on the right side, we have imposter attempts that they were trying to log in as someone else in the system. So we see that before protection, it was able to reject all the false attempts. But it also rejected some genuine attempts. And this is after the template protection. We see that here we have some imposter attempts being falsely accepted. And we also have, it looks like it might show better performance there, but it's, in general, the performance is worse since it's allowing some imposter attempts. Yeah. So that was the presentation. We have developed this system on smartphones and tested it, and we see that the problem, even if we can say that the security looks quite promising, there is still degradation in the performance after we apply the template protection method. But by fusing all the different modalities, we are able to increase the performance again. Yeah. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Martin, for the nice presentation.
Thank you.
I'd like to invite any questions the audience may have.
I just
could be the angle on how people have captured images. I think at least that's what the only thing I could think of, because when you capture it with the front camera, it's not the camera is not in the center of the phone usually, so there might be some deficiency in or in how they hold the phone, like, because they were not it would be very difficult to tell them to put the camera like right between your eyes, because that's not really how you hold the phone. So I think that would explain why there is some difference.
Any more questions?
Can you say something about the time it takes to process everything, including taking the phone and positioning it well enough such that a good picture can be made, and then processing the information on the phone?
Taking the picture is a bit difficult. Like, it really depends on the person. Some people are able to. I don't have any like specific time, but since most people are used to taking selfie, it's not that difficult. I don't have the time for the processing on the phone, but it's less than less than 5 seconds. And that's nothing is optimized in that case. So, yeah.
Okay. Any further questions that we may have can be put using the link that has been written on the board, and the same link is also provided to you in the welcome kit. Please use the system and also to write the questions that you feel are interesting. With that, I would like to thank Martin and all the speakers who contributed in the session one and session two. We have the lunch right outside here, and we go for the lunch, and we reconvene again at 13:45. Thank you.